Well, don't forget that nobody ever starts out trying to start a multi-billion dollar company. I sometimes look at these interviews with a founder and, you know, they ask of them about the idea and they say, well, we set out to reinvent communication or something like this. And really, I don't think anyone really sets out to do something like that. People tend to start out with a much smaller idea and it evolves. We didn't start a big giant enterprise. We started a very small thing and it grew from there.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Ausgabe von Handelsblatt Disrupt, dem Podcast über neue Ideen, Disruption und die Zukunft der digitalen Welt. Mein Name ist Sebastian Mattes und ich begrüße Sie wie immer ganz herzlich aus unserem Podcaststudio hier in Düsseldorf. Warum ist Deutschland so gern Lamoyant? Warum heißt es so oft ja, aber anstatt wie toll? Und warum werden Unternehmerinnen und Unternehmer gerade aus der Technologieszene nicht viel intensiver gefeiert bei uns? Die Fragen stelle nicht ich, sondern das fragt einer, der mit 16 in Irland irgendwo außerhalb von Limerick angefangen hat, am Computer zu daddeln. Der heute mit gerade einmal 32 Jahren auf ungefähr Platz 200 der reichsten Menschen der Welt steht und der gemeinsam mit seinem Bruder den Online-Bezahldienst Stripe gegründet hat. Ein Unternehmen, das von Investoren 2021 als das wertvollste Startup in den USA bezeichnet wurde. Was unsexy klingt, nämlich Zahlungen für Internetfirmen und E-Commerce im Hintergrund abzuwickeln, entwickelt sich also immer mehr zu einem attraktiven Geschäftsmodell und wächst so schnell, naja, wie Kunden ihre Einkäufe ins Netz verlagern. Über all das spreche ich heute mit dem Milliardär und Stripe-Mitgründer John Collison in San Francisco. Ich frage ihn auch nach seiner Einschätzung der aktuellen Krisenlagen. Wir sprechen über den Einbruch bei Tech-Werten und unterhalten uns über erfolgreiche Gründertrends in Europa im Vergleich zu China und den USA.
Nach einer kurzen Unterbrechung geht es gleich weiter. Bleiben Sie dran.
Generative KI hilft Unternehmen dabei, schneller, innovativer und effizienter zu werden. Doch wie können alle Mitarbeitenden diese revolutionäre Technologie im gesamten Unternehmen nutzen? Bertelsmann setzt dafür auf eine gemeinsam mit Deloitte entwickelte Plattform auf Basis von Campfire. Diese dient nicht nur als konzernweiter Software-as-a-Service-Marketplace, sondern auch als Distributionsplattform für eine Vielzahl von generativen AI-Anwendungen. Jetzt mehr erfahren auf deloitte.com/bertelsmann.
Und damit zu meinem Gespräch mit John Collison, der übrigens seit ein paar Jahren Deutsch lernt. Und deswegen schauen wir doch jetzt einfach mal, wie gut es schon läuft. Hi John.
Hallo.
Du bist ja einer der jüngsten Selfmade-Milliardäre der Welt, stehst ungefähr an Stelle 200 der reichsten Menschen. War das immer der Plan oder war das reiner Zufall?
Nein. Das war nicht unser Plan. Wir haben eine Startup gestartet und es war ein Erfolg, aber das war nicht unser Plan. Wir hatten früher eine andere Firma gegründet, Automatic, und das war eine sehr interessante Erfahrung, aber wir hatten da das Idee für Stripe. Wir merkten, das Schwerste von dieser Firma war nicht die Entwicklung der Software oder der Website. Mhm. Das Schwerste war, Geld von unseren Kunden anzunehmen. Und ja, das war die originale Idee für Stripe.
Okay, das werden wir gleich noch vertiefen. Dazu muss man sagen, das war jetzt eine kleine Überraschung, dass wir überhaupt auf Deutsch angefangen haben. John, du bist ja Ire und kannst aber doch trotzdem ganz gut Deutsch. Woran liegt das eigentlich? Wie ist deine Beziehung zu Deutschland?
Ja, wir sprechen nicht so viel Deutsch in Irland, aber es war meine Covid-Projekt, eine persönliche Herausforderung, Deutsch zu lernen. Und ich hatte Spaß.
Also nicht so schlecht. Das heißt, seit 2 Jahren sprichst du Deutsch?
Ja, es ist nicht so schlecht. Manchmal in Deutsch die Verben, you know, so oft auseinandergerissen werden. Gibt es
das hat Mark Twain schon kritisiert, von, ja, ja.
Ja. Gibt es so viele Jokes von Mark Twain? Ja. Ich weiß es nicht, aber er hat gesagt, okay, meine liebste Zitat ist, wenn gebildete Deutsche in einen Satz eintauchen, ist das Letzte, was du von ihnen siehst, bis sie am anderen Ende des Atlantiks mit dem Verb im Mund wieder auftauchen.
Ja, genau, das habe ich auch schon mal gehört. Und nochmal jetzt Hand aufs Herz, man lernt ja nicht einfach so Deutsch in Covid, oder? Es gibt ganz viele andere spannende Sachen, die man machen kann. Warum jetzt Deutsch?
Ja, aber ich bin ein bisschen komisch und in Covid, man kann nicht, you know, kann nicht so viel reisen, kann nicht andere Leute sehen und treffen. So, man muss eine neue Projekt finden.
Was hast du über Deutschland gelernt in der Zeit, in der du Deutsch gelernt hast? Man beschäftigt sich dann ja vielleicht auch ein bisschen intensiver mit dem Land.
Ich liebe Deutschland. Ich habe nach Deutschland gereist, aber auch die deutschen Leute, you know, gibt es. Es ist für die Geschäfts, es ist relevant. Gibt es einen deutschen Pessimismus und wir können über das sprechen auch. Aber ja, ich liebe Deutschland und die Deutschen.
So, some people that are listening to us right now may have not heard of Stripe. So, can you explain in very easy words what exactly you guys are doing?
Yeah, so Stripe builds financial infrastructure for the internet. We help online businesses collect money from their customers. And so to give you a sense of the, you know, the scale of this, you know, last year we processed $640 billion on behalf of our customers, and we serve millions of customers worldwide. And so they might use us kind of, a simple use case might be to use Stripe to collect payments over the internet, collect credit card payments, collect SEPA, Klarna, you know, some payment methods like this, because you as an internet business just wanted to make it easy for your customers to be able to pay you money. Mm. But increasingly, we provide the toolkit for running your internet business. Okay. And this is where I think the part of Stripe that is hard to understand comes in. So, you know, to give you maybe some concrete examples, we have a product called Stripe Connect that is infrastructure for building a marketplace. Because you think about it, many, actually ShareNow is a good example of this, you know, the subsidiary of Daimler, where they're, you know, it's a car sharing marketplace. And so handling payments on behalf of multiple parties is actually quite complex.
So, just to make it easy, you connect banks, credit cards, merchants, customers, and so on, right?
Exactly, and provide all the software for that. Okay. That's exactly right. Or another example might be Stripe Billing is the software infrastructure for managing a subscription business. So think about software as a service, like in Germany, we work with Celonis and Prisonio, mm-hmm. or think about media companies. And again, in Germany, you know, we would work with Axel Springer or Der Spiegel, or of course, Handelsblatt. And any kind of media company is probably sensitive to wanting to move beyond advertising-based revenue streams to actually having a strong subscription revenue stream. So often we're working with businesses to help them evolve and transform their business by building a marketplace, okay. by building a subscription line of business and providing the infrastructure.
And how does that look like, for example, talking about subscriptions like Handelsblatt has? So you guys are this button people click on, put their credit card numbers in, and you would collect the payment from the credit cards, put it to our account, right?
Yes, and part of what's a little, you know, many people listening have probably used a business that is powered by Stripe, perhaps without realizing it, because Stripe is the infrastructure and the software that sits in the background. Mm-hmm. And so when you use something that's powered by Stripe, you won't necessarily see a big Stripe logo, because again, we want to allow the business to own the customer experience. We want to allow the business to have their branding, but Stripe is running all the infrastructure in the background and making that easy and less complex for mm-hmm. them.
you talked about your story about how you founded your companies, but the story goes back way beyond the first company you just talked about. You have been interested in programming when you was 16. In what way have you been different to all your friends in school?
I think, not that many people were interested in programming in school, at least where I was. I think luckily it's becoming more common now and there is more of an emphasis on it. But at least back then, it was maybe more rare as an interest. Mm-hmm. And I think we were lucky to be able to be interested in that from an early age. And again, to find an idea that we liked early on, because like I mentioned, the idea from Stripe actually came from one of the previous projects where we were kind of hacking around, as they say, with a project. And that's what gave us the idea for Stripe.
So what exactly happened? What was the moment when you had this idea to found this multi-billion company?
Well, don't forget that nobody ever starts out trying to start a multi-billion dollar company. And I think this is one of the keys to being a Silicon Valley entrepreneur is that you have to pretend that your plan and your vision was much more figured out at the time than it actually was. I sometimes look at these interviews with a founder and, you know, they ask of them about the idea and they say, well, we set out to reinvent communication or something like this. And really, I don't think anyone really sets out to do something like that. People tend to start out with a much smaller idea and it evolves. And so really? At least for us, uh-huh. We had built an online business prior to Stripe and we had just found that the most difficult thing, the biggest challenge was not developing the software. It was not getting the customers. The most difficult thing was accepting money over the internet, because we can talk about this, but there are many reasons why it is much more complex than it needs to be. This was the biggest challenge we ran into in running our business. So we said, lots of other people presumably have this problem. Let's try starting a company to solve this and see where it goes. But to begin with, it was just myself and Patrick. It was just two people. We had a handful of customers. We didn't start a big, giant enterprise. We started a very small thing and it grew from there.
Right. And you found quite prominent investors, Elon Musk and Peter Thiel, for example, invested in your idea. How did you meet them?
We first did a program called Y Combinator, which is a startup accelerator in Silicon Valley. And from there, they made introductions to other investors. And, you know, as the business grew and we had more of a product and we had more revenue to talk about, again, they introduced us to further investors.
Okay. That sounds like a normal thing, but they are some of the most prominent investors in the world. So how was the first meeting with these two guys? Maybe let's start with Elon Musk.
Well, it's funny, right? Because, both were co-founders of PayPal. Mm-hmm. And so you can imagine, you go in to make this pitch that online payments is completely broken and it's far too difficult for internet businesses to have to deal with online payments. And you're making this pitch to the founders of PayPal. You know, it could go well or it could go poorly. But it went well. And I think they actually understood that there was a lot of work left to do. And again, as you look at the global internet economy, there's a huge amount of complexity that needs to be improved and abstracted compared to what existed back in 2009.
But anyway, everybody's asking now at this point of our conversation, how was this first meeting Peter Thiel or Elon Musk? So what kind of questions do they ask? I think they didn't just look into pitch desks, right?
I think any early stage technology investor is trying to answer maybe two things. One is this a good product today? And I think in our case, we had many, we got our start with kind of startups and developers. That has now grown where we work with all kinds of large companies. You know, we'll work with an Amazon or a Ford or someone like that. But back then we were working with startups. And so we were able to show that, the product worked very well for these kinds of companies and it was very popular with them. And so that's one thing that they would be looking to answer. And then another thing they would be looking to answer is, does this have room to grow? Could this business be 10 or 100 or maybe 1,000 times bigger than it is today. And again, I think as you look across the internet landscape, we were able to talk through, well, global payments is very complex. Like everyone, you know, we started with credit card payments in the United States, but you think about direct debit in Europe or all the local bank schemes, or even, I mean, now you have open banking and PSD2 and things like this, or Alipay and WeChat in China. You know, you could go through the different countries. You need to tie together these things. And now even we're getting into things like managing VAT for businesses. That's a source of real unnecessary complexity. And so even back then, I think we were able to paint a picture of there's a huge amount of complexity in running an online business.
Okay.
So this product is working today, and then it has room to grow.
Okay. Is there anything you learned from them? As you said, they've already invented some online payment system that everybody's using today. So is there anything these two entrepreneurs taught you in some ways?
They are, you know, maybe the some of the highest profile people who invested in Stripe, but honestly, they were not kind of the closest investors to the business. And so we always had a group of investors, including some who are on our board, like Mike Moritz from Sequoia, who we probably spent a little more time
with. We have to talk about a German company that also tried to offer payment solutions and failed. It was the biggest fraud in German history. It's Wirecard. It's a pretty similar idea. Is that something that affected your business somehow? Did you have more critical questions after the whole thing collapsed?
Wirecard was an odd one because they were obviously a huge fraud, but as a result, they had a prominent brand, but we seldom saw them in the marketplace. You know, even though they had this very prominent brand, they were not a company that we competed with, or, you know, maybe saw in a sales deal or something like that. And so, and maybe that's what you would expect because it was actually, you know, fully fraudulent. But we always found it odd along the way that we were, you know, always seeing this very, this big prominent name, but never saw them in the competitive marketplace. And I guess that's why, because it was a fraud.
And how did the scandal change the market?
I don't think it has, again, a bit because they were not a big, say in the European market, they were not a big presence in the market. And so I don't think it has changed things. But obviously, you know, now I read the same headlines you do about the kind of the investigations and the follow-up and things like that. But I would not say it's changed the market that much, again, because they were not a big presence. And again, in a way that we were always confused by.
By building companies, you've worked a lot with your brother. I was wondering, how does that work? I see quite a few stories of founders that started a company together as friends and it didn't really work out. So how does it work to do this with your brother together? What's the relationship you have?
For us, it works very well where we have a long-term vision for Stripe, and we have been working together on it for the last 12 years. I think we have plans for the next decades, and you know, we have a lot we can go into in terms of where we see Stripe going from here. But if you want to be able to work on something for a very long period of time, you want a high trust relationship. You want a you know, someone who you can work very effectively with. And so Patrick and I have a very good working relationship. We're, you know, somewhat different personalities, but I think somewhat complementary. We're always pushing each other on various ideas. So for us, it works well, but I think it, you know, it depends on the sibling, whether you can work effectively with them, but at least for us, it works well.
But how did it happen? You could have founded something with friends as well. So why your brother?
I mean, again, you know, when we started Stripe, this was many, many years ago. He was 21, I was 19. And so we did not have very extensive networks in the industry or something like that. You're maybe overestimating the number of qualified friends we had.
And in the meantime, you also play the piano, you have a pilot license. How is that possible while running such a big and quickly growing business?
Well, I think neither of those, I won't play anything for you right now because neither of those are things, I guess, as much time as I would like to spend on while running Stripe. So it's not a particularly compatible career with having time-intensive hobbies.
Okay. There are a lot of things going on in the market at the moment. In Germany, we have a pretty big fintech crisis, and you also lowered your valuation by, I think, 28% in June. So what is what is happening? Is that the fintech winter, as it's been called in Germany? And how's the outlook?
I think calling it a fintech crisis is would be overstating the matter. In tech, valuations go up, valuations go down, you know, in the stock market, same thing. And so as you look at technology valuations, they were at a very high point in 2021. They have since come back to maybe 2018 levels. But 2018 levels were not so bad and were quite healthy, actually. And then I think the other thing to keep in mind is to not mistake valuations for the substance of what's actually going on in the industry. And oftentimes, you know, post-crisis is when many of the interesting kind of things happen. And so if you look at, you know, a lot of people are comparing the present day to the crash of the dot-com bubble in 2000-2001. And that was a really bleak time. I mean, people working in technology thought, okay, technology is over, we have to move to a different industry. Amazon stock crashed 90% from where it had been. 90%, like not, you know, we're not talking about a 20% drop or a 50% drop, a 90% drop. Mm. And yet, in the 6 months following that crash, you had the emergence of, that was when Google AdWords was invented, which is basically kind of the most successful internet business model that has been invented. That was when Amazon launched Amazon Marketplace, which has gone on to be a majority of their retail business. And so I think it would be a mistake to kind of over-rotate on this period of valuations coming back, because that is often when some of the most interesting innovation comes from. And
you realize that some companies just don't have a business model, and that's what's happening in such crisis. And then maybe innovation has to happen to find such a business model, right?
Exactly. I think, you know, it puts pressure on companies to perform, to innovate. We saw this with COVID, for example, where a lot of legacy companies or, you know, previously offline businesses, they had maybe always had a plan to digitize that had been sitting on the shelf somewhere, or, you know, maybe they discussed it at every board meeting and it was very slowly moving along. And then when COVID came along, they said, oh, crap, we have to actually go do this. And we saw much faster movement. You know, we now work with many grocery stores, with many restaurants, because they said we have to digitize our payments much faster than previous. And so I think often these crises bring a sort of a stealing of the nerve and make things move much faster than they otherwise would.
But also critics say that parts of the fintech industry is just overestimated, and that there has been this big hype in the last couple of years, driven by exactly what you just mentioned, the boom after COVID. And now it turns out it's just not as valuable and they don't have business models. So it's coming back.
I think the critiques of fintech are a little overstated, where, again, if you look at, say, one of our customers in Germany, N26, why have they been successful? They've been successful because they delivered a much better customer experience that people actually prefer. And, you know, you remember, we've all used our mobile banking apps, you know, from some of the traditional banks who sometimes did not take the development of a good mobile app very seriously. And that actually matters to people, you know, from the day-to-day experience. And so, you know, that is why you're seeing them be successful. You know, so we could go through lots of other examples. And sometimes fintech, you know, I think we tend to jump to the most prominent names in fintech, like an N26 or a Klarna or someone like that. But we see lots and lots of fintech happening across different industries. And so, for example, Sides, I'm not sure if you're familiar with, they're a very large restaurant management platform in Germany, and they are working with kind of many large established brands like a McDonald's or a Burger King, but they're actually doing payments. And so integrated omni-channel payments so that people can pay online or in-store. That's a sort of fintech. It's a less prominent name, but they're being very successful.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of innovations in fintech, what are the most interesting innovations you see right now anywhere in the world in fintech?
Okay, so one that we're seeing a lot is the generalized form of maybe that Sides example, which is embedded financial services or software catering towards a particular industry or kind of particular niche starting to offer financial services as part of that. And so lending is maybe a good example here. We have a product called Stripe Capital, which provides automated machine learning-based loans to small businesses. Mm-hmm. So any small business who has gotten a loan previously from a bank will probably report that it's a pretty long and arduous process. There's lots of paperwork involved. Large banks have actually really, since the financial crisis, stepped back from lending in a big way to small businesses because it's quite expensive for them. You know, all the compliance costs and customer service costs are too high. And so we started with Stripe Capital lending to businesses on Stripe based on their cash flows because they're running all their payments through Stripe. So we can see, are they, you know, a good credit? Would they be able to to pay back a loan or not? What we then did is we started offering this product to our customers, many of the platforms. If you are helping e-commerce merchants, or if you're building a platform for plumbers, you can not only offer them payments, but offer them loans as well. And so oftentimes you have small businesses going not to a traditional bank for a loan, but maybe going to their software provider to give them a loan. There's a kind of a bank somewhere in the background, but they're going directly to the software company. We think this trend is very interesting because it often gives a better customer experience to the small business, where they're not having to wait around, they're not having to call up a bank, they're not having to fax paperwork.
Sure, but you become more and more like a bank, right? So do you need a banking license in the different countries?
No, so in this case, to make this product work, we actually work with a bank on the back end for the loans, and then we are we're the software provider, we're the distributor of the loans, but it's a bank who's actually kind of making the loans.
Okay, and the whole regulator's perspective, is that getting now much more complicated for you?
We process a lot of payments, and we are a large entity. And so we're regulated in more or less every market that we operate. So, for example, in Europe, our headquarters are in Dublin. So we're regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. They're our European regulator, and all the other markets around the world that we operate in. But I think sometimes, again, maybe sometimes business leaders come on a podcast like this and complain about, regulators and regulation. I think financial services is an interesting example of where I think in Europe in particular, this is an area where we have led and we are more advanced than many markets. So you look at the Payment Services Directive 2 and open banking, you look at some of the regulatory advances we have made, that has allowed for the emergence of fintech, the emergence of neobanks. Again, I mentioned someone like N26. There aren't really comparable companies in the United States because the fintech regulation is less advanced there.
Okay, so that's interesting. That leads us to a argument that has been made quite often, saying that Europe could be really strong in that field. Europe could also be leading in the field of fintechs compared to other markets. Is that true? Is that something that's actually happening?
Oh yeah, I think Europe is leading in the field of fintech, and many of our customers in Germany and in Europe more broadly, like N26, like Solaris Bank, are in the fintech sector. And again, I think because there tend to be more, there's a more stable and more permissive regulatory environment, it's also somewhere where pan-European regulation, we always with the EU have this goal of having nice, harmonized standardized regulation that enables businesses. I think everyone knows that the reality is more uneven. So in financial services, there is a passporting regime where a fintech can start up in one country and passport their regulatory status to all the other EU member states. That's very good. There are other areas where it works less well, where, again, one of the lines of business we have been going into is helping businesses manage VAT. And that's something where it's, you know, you talk to small businesses, mm-hmm. it's a bit of a mess for them. It's a cause of headaches. The pan-European standardization is not that good. And as a result, they need something like Stripe to help them. So I think in some case, we are sometimes more successful at the single digital market or the pan-European standardization than in other cases.
But when we look into the United States, not all of the fintechs are very successful. Some of them are not at all. So why is that so difficult? If your call would be true and Europe is leading in fintech, European fintechs must be also leading in all the huge markets, which is not true for so many of the biggest fintechs in Europe, especially N26, for example, failed completely in the United States. So what did you guys do differently that you could succeed somehow everywhere?
Well, I wish we were succeeding everywhere, yes, but let's not give us too much credit. But we're certainly in many markets around the world. I think with fintech, because the kind of product is shaped by the local regulation and the local norms in the market, I think you need to be quite cognizant of the local market considerations. And, you know, so in Germany, for example, there is this skepticism of credit that definitely does not exist in the United States. They're big fans of credit over there. But you have these different almost kind of personality differences between the countries. And so as a result, I think you tend to see in fintech generally regional winners more than global winners. And so you have a set of fintech companies that are successful in the United States, like maybe Square Cash or Chime or pick your example. You have a set of companies that are successful in Europe, like N26 or Revolut or someone like this. And then in Brazil, it's different again. But you don't tend to see global winners to the same extent. Mm-hmm. I think for us, it's not easy. We work very hard to understand markets locally. You know, we first started hiring people in Germany.
I think everybody would say that, right? All fintechs would say that about themselves.
Sure, but again, we've been, you know, we've been investing in Germany now for 10 years. You know, it was not an overnight thing. And I think also you need to have a bit of the perspective. I think sometimes when American companies try to expand into a foreign market and bring an American product and just roll it out there, that doesn't work well. I think it's maybe helpful for us that we grew up in Ireland. We have some more of the European perspective and we understand kind of the differences in the products that are required. I spend actually a decent amount of time still in Ireland myself, but I think you need to have that international perspective and you need to really put in the effort where for us, it has not been an overnight success. It's been many, many years in the making. And I think sometimes companies don't have the patience. You know, they try it for a year or two and then they say, this is hard. Whereas we've been trying it for, again, in Germany for 8 years. Mm.
So we talked about your valuation. We've talked about the story, your story about your company. So the big question is, when will you go public? When is your IPO?
We're very happy as a private company. We have no plans to go public.
Not at all. Why is that?
Because we have a long-term vision for Stripe and we are still in the relatively early stages of executing on this vision. We have achieved, you know, some success in the United States and in Europe, but we're now expanding quite rapidly in Latin America. We just made an acquisition in Africa. And so we have a lot of expansion yet to do. And then also, the business is not terribly capital consumptive. So a traditional reason people might go to the public markets is because they want to raise a large round of financing. And in Stripe's case, the business does not consume a lot of capital. It's a very capital efficient business model. And so that is less relevant as a consideration.
So your investors are not pushing to go public?
They are not, you know, they are not in a big rush now.
Okay. So let's talk about Europe. There's a big discussion at the moment, at least in Europe, how the European tech scene will look like in a couple of years. Obviously, you've seen the big conflict between the United States and China, a conflict that mm-hmm. has a lot to do with technology as well. So the big question is, what could a role for Europe look like? Is there something Europe can do better than all the other regions, or will the good old continent somehow be stuck in the middle between the tech superpowers?
I think Europe tends to be overly pessimistic on its tech scene, or overly bashful. The European tech scene is already doing very well. And if you look at it by the numbers, 85 new unicorns were minted in Europe in 2021. And that was twice or three times the number in China. And so, sometimes we compare ourselves with China as if how could we ever catch up? Whereas as you look at some of the numbers, it's doing quite well already. I think we should be thinking about, what sectors can Europe really lead in?
Exactly.
And we talked about one as an example with fintech, where again, I think because we have a better regulatory apparatus for fintech, that has allowed for the emergence of neobanks, that has allowed for the emergence of, pan-European payment systems and some of these kinds of things that are instrumental in powering the fintech ecosystem that maybe don't exist in some other markets. So, okay, that's one. We think Europe can be a leader in fintech, and I would argue already is. Some of the most interesting fintech companies are, take Revolut, another customer of ours. There's no equivalent in somewhere like the United States. So that's one area. Another that we're quite interested in is climate. We have a program called Stripe Climate, where we are funding carbon removal, and we are the we can get into this, but we're kind of the initial customer for many new carbon removal companies. But I think that Europe should be thinking about how to become the leader in carbon removal technologies and climate companies, because you think about it, the mandate for this is so much stronger in Europe than it is in somewhere like the United States. I think it would be a real shame if many of the most successful climate companies ended up not being in Europe, given that this is where you have a lot of the skills and you have the strong mandate. Mm-hmm. And then I think you think about what are some traditional businesses that could be perhaps transformed by modern technological approaches. And so you look at the German Mittelstand industries or the car industry, and what does the modern tech-enabled version of these look like? The more startup-y version of these look like. But those would be some of the areas where I think we should be thinking about where the European tech scene can be a leader.
You are obviously pretty optimistic, and I think you are right in some points, but also when you look at the stock market, you have many companies that have been there for decades now, and that's pretty different to the United States. So there's a lot of catching up still to do, right?
Yes, but again, I think if you look at the early stage signs, I think you have to be quite optimistic. And again, as I compare from when I first, left in 2009 to now when I come back, there's all sorts of interest. I mean, when I come to Germany, it's funny, right? Because, with the German federalism, there is not one hub for tech. It's not like, if I go to the UK, I can just go to London. If I go to France, I can just go to Paris. When I come to Germany, often I have to go to Berlin and Munich and Hamburg, and you're jumping around because there's so much interesting tech stuff happening in all these places. So it's a good problem to have. And again, I think it's maybe quite different to where things were even 10 or 15 years ago, when there was not as much successful SaaS. You're now starting to see, these ecosystems form. Same in Berlin, where you have people graduate from one startup and go to another. Mm.
But since you've seen all the systems, at least in the United States and in Europe, is there something Europe could learn from the United States in organizing innovation, in organizing tech ecosystem?
For sure. So I think there are some quite concrete things. Firstly, there is a particularly European, especially, you know, German pessimism that, you know, that sometimes emerges with these things. I mean, even as we're having your this debate, you know, you're saying that, yes, I mean, there's some cause for happiness, but don't forget the bad things. And I think, you know, the American perspective tends to be much more optimistic on what could go right as opposed to what could go wrong. And relatedly, I think America just celebrates entrepreneurs more. And I think that's actually quite important. I am obsessed with one of our customers and a company I know reasonably well is Celonis.
Celonis is a so-called data mining company, a SaaS company, software as a service that focuses on optimizing internal processes and therefore saves companies, as at least they say, large amounts of money. For example, Lufthansa, right?
Yeah, and one of the most successful companies to come out of Germany over the past 10 years. I think those guys are amazing and one of the most successful SaaS companies to emerge of late. And if that was in the United States, or even if that was in Ireland, I think there would be lots of headlines about this really exciting new you know, tech company. Whereas actually, you know, in Germany, not that many people outside of the tech world know Celonis. I think that's crazy because it's one of the most exciting, you know, new German stories of the last 10 years. And it's interesting to me that I think a lot of Europe does not celebrate entrepreneurs. And maybe then the last thing is historically, entrepreneurship in many parts of Europe, not just Germany, but many parts of Europe, has been more about the kind of the business founders, the guy in the suit, you know, historically a guy who was coming up with the business plan and pitching investors. And maybe there was an underrating of the technical founders and the developers. And again, in Silicon Valley, I think part of what makes the system work well is there's a belief in strong technical founders being very important and strong software engineers. Mm-hmm. And you're starting to see that shift a little bit, where obviously Germany has and Europe has huge numbers of very strong software engineers. So it's not a problem of do we have the skills? I think it's more where does everyone sit in the pecking order? And you're starting to see that change.
For you, was it always clear that you will become an entrepreneur, or was there any time that you thought, okay, maybe McKinsey would be an option as well or something else? I mean, you've been at Harvard and you could have done anything else, right?
Yeah, I started on entrepreneurship early enough. You know, we started our first company when I was 16. That I was lucky. I did not get to thinking about the dark arts like going and becoming a McKinsey consultant.
Okay, so it was never an option to do anything else.
No, I mean, I just got into entrepreneurship from a very young age.
Why did you go to Harvard and then quit anyway?
you sound like my mother, who tried to when I was going there encouraged me to not drop out. But you know, I say that jokingly. Our parents were always very supportive, even of our quite crazy plans. You know, I was going to college like any normal student, and then we started Stripe while in college, actually. So for the first part, we were doing Stripe part-time, and then the product just started to take off, you know, so we spent a summer on it and then continued, and then, you know, it ended up becoming a full-time thing. But I was pulled out by Stripe, really.
Okay, and what did your parents say? Anyway, what did your mother say then?
They have actually always been really kind of surprisingly and impressively supportive of our crazy schemes. Both my parents were entrepreneurs. They ran their own small businesses.
Yeah, it is in a hotel, right?
My dad ran a hotel, exactly. Mm. And then my mom ran an employee training firm. So many of the, you know, American companies that would set up base in Ireland needed to do employee training, and they provided that. But I think, you know, when you're growing up, you just think this is normal. You know, this is what parents do. They run a small business. And then maybe as you age, you realize that things maybe had an influence on you that you did not realize.
So what did you learn about entrepreneurship from the time you grew up?
I think the biggest thing was just the work ethic. They worked so much. They were so hardworking. And our mother was raising us while running a small business. Three boys. It was not simple. And then our father similarly was a hotel is just, it really eats you. It's so much work. It's 24/7. Mm-hmm. And so they just worked so hard. And I think.
Nach einer kurzen Unterbrechung geht es gleich weiter. Bleiben Sie dran.
Willkommen in der Zukunft der Technologie mit dem Handelsblatt Summit Zukunft IT. Seien Sie Teil der IT-Flagship-Tagung des Handelsblatts, bei welcher führende Köpfe der IT-Branche zusammenkommen, um die neuesten Trends und Herausforderungen der digitalen Transformation zu diskutieren. Vernetzen Sie sich mit Branchenführern und finden Sie Lösungen, die Ihr Unternehmen voranbringen. Exklusiv für unsere Podcast-Hörer sichern Sie sich jetzt 20% Rabatt auf Ihre Anmeldung. Besuchen Sie zukunft-it.jetzt und verwenden Sie den Vorteilscode PODCAST.
That was probably a useful lesson to take in.
With a lot of listeners, I know from lots of emails I get after podcasts like this, and they're always interested in things you learned in your life. So you are very optimistic. We've learned that already about you, and you have an optimistic view on the world, on Europe, on Germany, even. Mm-hmm. But I was
against the wishes of the Germans who want to find the negative angle.
I'm only asking the questions, but I was wondering. So I was wondering, what was maybe the biggest mistake you've done as an entrepreneur, and what did you learn about entrepreneurship, about yourself, about business, maybe?
Obviously we haven't had too many serious mistakes because maybe Stripe would not be here if so. Maybe one slightly funny mistake, at least at the time, was our previous business before Stripe, when we were selling it, we had two offers of who to sell it to. One was a kind of a no-name company in Canada, a small firm that did not really end up going anywhere. And the other was that was the company that ended up, buying us. Where we chose their offer, and the offer we turned down was Facebook. That would have been an offer for stock. And this was back in 2008, so that would have been their second ever acquisition. At the time, a few years later, we said, maybe being acquired by Facebook would have been a good idea. But of course, then we probably would have gone on to be employees at Facebook and not start Stripe at all. So I think sometimes you can, in the near term, view these things as a mistake, but maybe in the longer term, it actually all works out.
Okay. I know this from discussions with our audience. Some of them think about building their own business maybe. So is there anything you've learned about entrepreneurs? For example, how do you realize somebody can be a good entrepreneur? Is there something, some ability you always see in successful entrepreneurs?
I think the first thing people need to understand in looking at starting a company is that so much of the details get rewritten. I think this is particularly a Silicon Valley phenomenon, that the early stages of a company are kind of messy and you're figuring out what the product should be. And then when people tell the story 5 or 10 years later, they have a lot more conviction and they have airbrushed the story and it looks perfect now. And it's as if they set out to do exactly what they ended up doing. But there is a messy discovery phase at the beginning of every company that, again, I think tends to get removed from the story just for simplicity, if nothing else. I don't think it's actually, dishonest or anything like that. It's just as people look at this stuff in hindsight, they kind of forget some of the details. So that's, I think, one thing that's important to remember. The other thing, of course, is that every business tends to start with a customer problem. developing conviction that there is a real problem that customers have. And so again, in Stripe's case, it was that as we talked to internet businesses, they had a really hard time accepting money online from their customers. They found it very cumbersome and very difficult. And we said, maybe there's an easier way for this to work. But I think that is the kernel of every new company is a customer problem. And a lot of the strongest entrepreneurs are very focused on what do customers want? What's a good product for customers? And sometimes the opportunities come from the fact that maybe the existing firms, the incumbents, have gotten a little lazy. They've gotten a little fat. You know, again, we talked about neobanks. This is maybe a good example here. Mm-hmm. Everyone knew that the mobile banking apps were terrible that were provided, by their banks. And so I think the neobanks just looked at the experience and said, okay, you know, we can build a much nicer customer experience. This is how people want to interact with their bank. Okay, there's some regulatory complexity. We'll go understand that. We'll go become, regulated as a bank. But I think that is the mindset that, we try to have is this very strong customer focus. And we still have it in every new product we launch, where the leaders of the product will spend a lot of time with actual customers themselves. Patrick and I still spend a huge amount of time with Stripe customers in our Monday morning meetings. We'll often bring a customer to come talk to the leadership team. So we really try to have that obsession about customers. And I think that is what a lot of the successful companies tend to have.
Okay. The big news at the moment is the war in Ukraine. So how do you think this conflict will affect tech and change the economy in the next couple of months and years maybe?
Clearly the macro environment is tougher than it was perhaps a year ago. Though also, you have to remember again that many of the problems that tech companies are solving still need to be solved, even in a more recessionary environment. And I think it's very evident that tech is here to stay and these problems need to be solved.
But even though tech is in crisis, I mean, Facebook and Google are like stop hiring people at the moment. So that's a huge crisis. So is that really so optimistic, the outlook?
Oh, yeah. I would not go so far as to call it a crisis. I mean, I think it's sensible to stop hiring if, the business is slowing down a little bit. They will start hiring again. They have not hired their last people. If they put a pause on hiring, it's probably a prudent thing to do. Mm-hmm. And then they will restart again. I don't know. Maybe it's next year or something like that. And of course, they are already very large, successful, profitable companies with useful products. So I don't think it's a crisis. I think it's more par for the course in an environment where, they are maybe going to be a bit less profitable than they projected. In Stripe's case, we slowed down our hiring. Again, similarly, we think it's prudent, but we're still going to grow considerably this year. 2022 will be a much larger year for us in terms of revenue than 2021.
So how much did you grow? How much will you grow?
We don't release the actual numbers. And of course, we don't know this year. But my point is more that I think the trends that are driving these technology companies, say in our case, the fact that the online economy, is growing, the online economy will continue to grow even in a recession. I mean, in some cases, it may actually grow faster because you think about it, if buying online is a cheaper option than going into a store, then maybe as people become more price sensitive, during a recession, mm-hmm. then maybe that accelerates the move to online. And so I think often the trends that are driving these tech companies, they don't stop being relevant in a recession, and sometimes they become more relevant.
Mm-hmm. So last question, you talked a lot about that good entrepreneurs find solutions for problems, and that's also often the core for great companies. So what would be a problem that have to be solved? Maybe you would like to solve it somehow or somebody else should. What kind of problem would that be?
Maybe one example of a somewhat disconnected problem that we have decided to tackle is, like I mentioned, Stripe Climate, where our core focus is payments and infrastructure for internet businesses to be able to move money. But we are quite interested also in the problem of climate change and, you know, just the need to reduce the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. And we think that is a tractable problem. And again, you know, you said we tend to be optimistic, which I think is right. And I think a lot of the climate dialogue has become overly pessimistic and maybe somewhat fatalistic that, you know, we must all be resigned to our fate. Whereas actually, there are technological solutions to this. Again, Stripe has started funding and Stripe's customers have started funding carbon removal technologies. So now when you sign up for Stripe, we offer you the ability to put 1% of your revenue towards funding carbon removal technologies. And now it is a coalition. There are tens of thousands of businesses that are doing so. So
how much money did you collect? How much money did you collect?
So it is now in the, you know, when we started, it was first in the millions and then in the tens of millions. We actually announced this year an initiative called Frontier, which is an advanced market commitment. So this is when you say upfront, we are planning to spend this much on, you know, something. And the idea here is that you help kickstart the industry. You make it so that people want to start companies, investors want to fund these companies because they see that the demand is there because these commitments have been made. So it was previously something used for vaccines to encourage vaccine development, and now we are applying it to carbon removal. And that was $900 million. That was not just Stripe. We had a number of other forward-thinking companies, Google and JP Morgan and people like that, join us in making that commitment. But there's a set of large companies that have committed to $900 million for carbon removal, which is vastly more than the amount that has been spent on carbon removal to date.
What is the biggest news we are going to read about Stripe in the next couple of months?
I think you will see us launch more products. And so, you know, again, we talked a little bit about some of the new areas that we are going into around some of the software as a service we're offering to simplify running an online business, around this embedded finance or maybe banking as a service. So you'll definitely see that. And in Germany, I think you will see there are many great, you know, traditional German businesses, you know, some I can't even talk about yet, but I think over the coming months, you will maybe see us talk about some very well-known German businesses that are increasingly turning to Stripe to reinvent their businesses.
But you will never become a bank.
Well, we will not become a bank, no.
John, thank you so much.
This was excellent. I really enjoyed it.
Und damit sind wir auch schon wieder am Ende von Handelsblatt Disrupt. Wie immer freue ich mich über Kommentare in der Handelsblatt Disrupt LinkedIn-Gruppe oder senden Sie mir gerne eine Mail. Die Details finden Sie in den Shownotes. Danke an dieser Stelle auch für die Unterstützung von Max Flohr und Regina Körner und Migo Fecke von professionalpodcast.com, dem Dienstleister für Strategieberatung und Podcastproduktion. Wenn Sie grundsätzlich immer auf dem Laufenden sein wollen, dann testen Sie doch gern unser exklusives Abo-Angebot für Sie als Handelsblatt Disrupt Hörerin oder Hörer. Damit lesen Sie nicht nur alle aktuellen Artikel und haben Zugang zu unserem Archiv. Sie können natürlich auch alle Podcasts hören. Schauen Sie doch einfach mal nach unter www.handelsblatt.com/Mehrwirtschaft. Die Details auch dazu finden Sie natürlich in den Shownotes. Wir hören uns dann nächste Woche Freitag wieder. Bis dahin wünsche ich Ihnen interessante digitale, aber natürlich auch analoge Zeiten. Ihr Sebastian Mattes.
Bist du auf der Suche nach Inspiration und Netzwerkmöglichkeiten? Dann ist das Summer Camp der Handelsblatt Media Group genau das Richtige für dich. Treffe über 800 EntscheiderInnen, nimm an interaktiven Workshops teil und werde Teil der einzigartigen Camp-Community. Wir wollen gemeinsam mit dir die Zukunft unserer Wirtschaft gestalten und aktuelle Herausforderungen angehen. Erfahre mehr und sichere dir noch heute dein Ticket auf hmg-summercamp.de.